The head of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, was killed mysteriously in 1961. Stay with us as we tackle this unsolved mystery on USUN Report.
It's time for USUN Report. Here's Tom Osborne.
These are the headlines making news. The Trump administration is military operations against Syria. House Speaker Paul Ryan says he will not run for re-election, citing family responsibilities. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen calls a 200% spike in illegal border crossings in March compared with a year ago, quote, a dangerous story, as she pressed lawmakers Wednesday to provide funding for President Trump's proposed wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. Nielsen appeared before the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Homeland Security to push for approval of the Trump administration's $47.5 billion fiscal year 2019 budget request. Our relationship with Russia is worse now than it has ever been, and that includes the Cold War, Trump said. There is no reason for this. Russia needs us to help their economy, something that would be very easy to do, and we need all nations to work together to stop the arms race.
And that brings us to the subject of our discussion today on USUN Report, Dag Hammarskjöld, the second Secretary General of the United Nations. And our thanks to Dr. David Canerbo, our resident historian, who is going to tell us the backstory of Dag Hammarskjöld. David?
Thank you, Tom. Dag Hammarskjöld was born in Jönköping, Sweden, in 1905. He spent most of his childhood nearby in Uppsala, Sweden. He graduated from Uppsala University in 1925 with a degree in humanities. Because of his degree, he developed a strong interest in poetry, painting, and music, and in his later years, in Christian theology. He earned a second degree at Uppsala in 1928 in economics, a law degree in 1930, and a doctoral degree in economics in 1934. He entered public service and devoted 31 years of his life to public service in Sweden, both in financial affairs and foreign relations, and also in global international affairs through the United Nations. He held a number of different positions during his lifetime, culminating in his role as Secretary General of the United Nations from 1953 to 1961. During his Secretary Generalship, he was a very active pursuer of peace. He died in a plane crash in 1961 near the border of Katanga and Zambia on a peace mission. He was described by President John F. Kennedy as, quote, the greatest statesman of our century. Ken?
I'd like to begin our discussion right after this, our first roll-in today from Khrushchev in 1960, addressing the UN General Assembly.
A day of high drama and momentous events in the current historic session of the United Nations. For the third time, Nikita Khrushchev takes the stand to repeat his demands for the admission of Red China, the drastic reorganization of the World Body Secretariat, and the resignation of Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld.
Уважаемый господин председатель, господа делегаты.
Speaking in measured tones that are the more convincing for the contrast with his previous angry outbursts, Khrushchev threatens that if his demands are not met, the Red Bloc will bypass the United Nations, a hint that the Soviet might directly intervene in the Congo, disregarding United Nations peace efforts there.
Речь идет о роли и месте исполнительного органа ООН, который мы предлагаем вместо...
Calmly and deliberately, Khrushchev opens the day with a calculated expression of one of the hardest Soviet lines yet voiced.
Tom, why did you start off our discussion about Dag Hammarskjöld? Why was he so controversial?
Well, he was a very complex person, as his bio spells out very clearly. One of the things that fascinates me about him is his background in theology. The mix of theology and politics can be a very dangerous brew. But on the other hand, if you're studying theology in depth, you find out that you have a lot in common with very different people across the globe. And the amount of theology that he studied indicated that he was a person who could understand the very basics of what people believed and what they longed for, and the better part of our human nature. He was overall a brilliant person, a person probably exceptional beyond anyone we've had in the last century. He certainly changed the way we look at the world, and he was not afraid to take on Khrushchev and meet him head on. And of course, this was very helpful to the United States, and sometimes he was not so helpful, and we'll talk more about that, which actually ended in real tragedy. Ken?
Well, interestingly enough, that April 10th was the day he took the oath of Secretary General of the United Nations. Prior to that, Trygg Lie, a Norwegian, had handed in his letter of resignation. And at first I thought, well, I wonder why he resigned. But it turns out that each Secretary General serves a term of 5 years, which is renewable for another 5 years. So I think Trygg Lie just wanted out. It's a tough job. David Canerva, what were you able to find out about Dag Hammarskjöld? Did he have any idea he was being drafted for the role?
I don't know that he knew he was being drafted, but certainly he appeared to be someone who had all the right connections, all the right background, the training back in Sweden to fulfill that role. He was an outstanding person in a lot of ways because of his interests, his scholarship, his past activities in Swedish and world economics. And so certainly he stood out as someone from a neutral country, which Sweden was, who could fulfill the role in a very balanced and fair way. Ken?
Mr. Hammarskjöld was indeed stunned when he received the news. He had neither the wish nor the ambition to be Secretary General of the United Nations. But on April 7th, 1953, the General Assembly voted by secret ballot and adopted by 57 votes to one, with one abstention, the recommendation of the Security Council to appoint Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld as the second Secretary General of the United Nations. And when he arrived in New York on the 9th of April, he was met at the airport by Trygg Lie, who told him he was about to take over. That must have been a rather stunning realization. Tom Osborne?
I certainly think it was probably very stunning, especially when he did not expect it, a man of such ability, being vaulted to such great importance. And we'll be talking more about that as we go along, I'm sure, Ken.
In a prepared statement to the press, Mr. Hammarskjöld introduced himself and introduced the outlines that were his beliefs. He said, "In my new official capacity, the private man should disappear and the international public servant take his place." You're listening to USUN Report with Tom Osborne, Dr. David Canerva, and Ken McCaleb. We have to take a short break, but we'll be back right after this. Stay with us. Welcome back to USUN Report with Tom Osborne, Dr. David Canerva, and Ken McCaleb. We're talking today about UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld. Who was he, and why is he so important to recognize historically today? Here's what JFK had to say in 1961.
Dag Hammarskjöld is dead, but the United Nations lives. His tragedy is deep in our hearts, but the tasks for which he died are at the top of our agenda. A noble servant of peace is gone, but the quest for peace lies before us. The problem is not the death of one man. The problem is the life of this organization. It will either grow to meet the challenges of our age, or it will be gone with the wind, without influence, without force, without respect. Were we to let it die, to enfeeble its vigor, to cripple its powers, we would condemn our future.
Tom Osborne, JFK seemed to be a rather big fan of Dag Hammarskjöld. Is that your understanding?
Yes, I think he was a very big fan of Dag Hammarskjöld. He was an internationalist in his heart. Kennedy was no isolationist, and he saw the UN in idealistic terms, at least in terms of selling it to the United States and having us take a more active role. He saw us as being crucial to the United Nations, at least in terms of our influence, our values, and really those are the things that built the United Nations from the beginning. So He was a very complex person and was the right man for the right time with the right president of the United States. It just happened to work. And, of course, in these situations, not everyone was happy, and we'll find out more about that. Ken?
Well, as a statesman and the son of a former prime minister of Sweden, Dag Hammarskjöld was born in Jönköping, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, Sweden, on July 29, 1905, with a doctorate in economics. Hammarskjöld served 31 years in Swedish national affairs and international relations. On April 7, 1953, he was appointed the second Secretary General of the United Nations. Dag was close to his parents, and their approach to life greatly influenced him. Now, David, you've got some more personal information on Dag Hammarskjöld. Could you share that with us?
Sure, Ken. He spoke about the influence of his parents on his life, and this is what he said, quoting from one of his statements. From generations of soldiers and government officials on my father's side, I inherited a belief that no life was more satisfactory than one of selfless service to your country or humanity. This service required a sacrifice of all personal interests, but likewise the courage to stand up unflinchingly for your convictions. And then from his mother's side, he inherited an interest in scholars and clergymen. He says, I inherited a belief that in the very radical sense of the Gospels, all men were equals as children of God and should be met and treated by us as our masters in God. So, as Tom alluded to, this was a person who was interested in theology, person who had a very strong background, both in terms of public service and also in clerical work as well from his mother's side of the family. He was someone who was very bright, an outstanding student. He not only, though, was an academic in the sense of being intellectually superior, but also he was someone who performed in gymnastics. He was a strong skier, as so many, of course, people in Sweden are. He was a mountaineer. He was served as the president of the Swedish Alpinist Club. And so, as one person put it, he was someone who was, in many ways, a Renaissance man. Ken?
In 1925, Hammarskjöld earned a degree in humanities from Uppsala University and then returned for a second degree in economics, which he completed 3 years later. And he earned his law degree in 1930 and his doctorate in economics in 1934. Shortly after wrapping up his doctorate degree, Hammarskjöld was appointed Secretary of the Bank of Sweden, a position he held for only 1 year before moving on to a 9-year post as Undersecretary in the Ministry of Finance. Tom Osborne, he seemed destined for international politics at this point, didn't he?
Yes, he did, Ken. As I was saying, he seemed to be a man for all seasons, all the problems that we faced in the world. He was prepared at least to know where to begin to solve them. And this at a crucial time, too, when we had a new government in the United States, and there was a feeling that anything was possible. And, of course, a lot of the idealism that the UN was born with was still there. And I think also Dag Hammarskjöld made the imprint of what he saw as what is the role of the Secretary General of the United Nations. And he was no shrinking violet. I think he saw a very strong and dynamic position in the Secretary General, and he felt that he had to fulfill that with his responsibility. And so he was not afraid to buck the permanent five. If he disagreed with them, this would catch up to him. But as I said, he would proceed without, with or without their permission. And that, of course, is something that we had to put a check on in the UN. And it was, of course, something that stayed with the UN since Dag Hammarskjöld's time in office. I think the closest we came to having such freewheeling leadership was probably with Kofi Annan. And of course, there's Boutros-Boutros-Ghali, and that ended in real tragedy, but that's another story. We can talk about that another day. Ken?
You know, I did have the pleasure of working with four of the Secretary Generals, and my first one being Peres de Cuellar, followed by Boutros-Ghali, and followed by Kofi Annan, and last but not least, Ban Ki-moon. Now, in that time, David, you and I were talking before the show, alluded that there were two most successful or considered the best secretary generals, and Tom just mentioned the other one. Can you review with me Kofi Annan's success and similarities?
Well, Kofi Annan was the second most successful United Nations Secretary General, Dag Hammarskjöld being the other one. Kofi Annan seemed to be someone like Hammarskjöld in the sense that he was very active, somewhat of a hands-on negotiator and activist in trying to get the UN to do all that it could to fulfill its mission of both developing the poor parts of the world economically, but also seeking to bring peace where there was war. Ken?
Tom Osborne, he, as successful as Dag Hammarskjöld was, he had trouble being viewed by the Soviets as simply an agent of the West, and he had trouble earning the country's confidence. And isn't that why he called for Dag Hammarskjöld to resign?
Well, I think that was a great part of it. It certainly was not he was not a favorite of the Soviets, and he made it clear that he wasn't necessarily going to back down from them when the UN Security Council voted. He expected that to be followed. But he was a tough guy, and he was also a brilliant man and an excellent debater, and he could hold his own on any floor or any subject throughout the world. So he was one of the rarest of people that we've had in that position. Ken?
Dr. Kanervo, in 1955, he secured a major victory when he got the release of 15 American pilots being held hostage by the Chinese. And he was elected to a second term as Secretary General in 1957. Do you know the story about China, and where was its position in the world theater at this point?
Well, of course, it was an ally of North Korea. We had just completed a war with North Korea with a truce settlement signed in 1953. The Chinese still had some American airmen, soldiers, who were captives from that war, and Dag Hammarskjöld was personally able to go in, negotiate with the Chinese, and secure the release of the American soldiers captured by the Chinese during that war. Ken?
And Tom, isn't it true that at that point China wasn't even a member of the United Nations?
I'm not sure the timing of that, Ken. I don't believe they were, actually.
Ken, if I can, I can answer that. You're right that Communist China was not a member of the United Nations at that time. That seat was, of course, filled by the nationalist government in Taiwan, and it was not until, I think, about 91 or so when Red China was made a member.
You're listening to U.S. UN Report with Tom Osborne, Dr. David Kanervo, and Ken McCaleb. We're up against a heartbreak, but we'll be back right after these messages.
Welcome back to U.S. UN Report. I'm David Kanervo, along with Ken McCaleb and Tom Osborne, and we're talking about Dag Hammarskjöld. Ken?
Thank you, David. Here's an audio clip from a 2015 press conference I got to direct with Farhan Haq of the UN Department of Public Information.
Concerning the death of Dag Hammarskjöld and the members of the party accompanying him, the Secretary General is pleased to announce that he transmitted the report of the eminent person appointed pursuant to General Assembly Resolution 71/260 to the President of the General Assembly, together with his own observations on the progress made and on the way forward in the search for the truth relating to the conditions and circumstances resulting in the tragic death of Dag Hammarskjöld and of the members of the party accompanying him. The eminent person concluded in his report that it is almost certain that Dag Hammarskjöld and the members of the party accompanying him were not assassinated after landing, and that all passengers died from injuries sustained during the plane crash, either instantaneously or soon after. As to the cause of the crash, the eminent person considered it plausible that an external attack or threat may have been the cause. The eminent person also noted that it remains possible that the crash was an accident caused by pilot error without external interference, and that it was plausible that human factors, including fatigue, played a role in the crash.
Now, you've just heard Farhan. He used to be a reporter for NPR. Tom, you worked with him.
Well, yes. Farhan and I worked together. Actually, I think he was there before I was, or about the same time that I arrived in 1989. So, yeah, we go back quite a few years. Interesting how he characterizes the report, and I'm looking forward to providing some more details on that. But it was never really that conclusive, as he suggests, and I think that is probably still a situation which is covered up a lot.
What I found interesting was here we are in 2015, many, many years later, and the General Assembly is opening up this examination. So obviously there is no conclusive closing of the book on this, because they're still looking into what actually happened. Now, my guess is that at this point, it's a hot potato and nobody wants to take it. David, your thoughts?
Well, I think that's certainly true, Ken. One of the things that struck me as I looked at the information that is publicly available is that both Britain and the United States may have had some hand in the death. And perhaps we're going to talk about that more later, but certainly it appears that the British have not been very forthcoming at all with a lot of the data. Subsequent eyewitness accounts have talked about his plane being shot down by another plane flying overhead, and that the scene was covered up and not released to public view until much later. For example, eyewitnesses said that once the plane went down, that there were army people, security people, around the crash site as early as 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and yet the news media were told that his body in the plane crash were discovered at 3 p.m., which gave plenty of time for things to happen there on the crash site to cover things up. And so there's a lot of information which certainly feeds the notions of conspiracy theorists. Ken?
Well, that's a 12-hour discrepancy. And Tom Osborne, what have you stumbled on? I mean, this is a good time to bring it up.
Well, of course, there is new evidence has emerged in one of the most enduring mysteries of the United Nations and African history. It suggests that the plane carrying the Secretary General was shot down over northern Rhodesia, and the murder was covered up by British colonial authorities. This, according to The Guardian. They ran a very long and detailed piece, which is very interesting, saying that the British-run Commission of Inquiry blamed the crash in 1961 on pilot error, as David suggested, and a later UN investigation largely rubber-stamped these findings. They ignored or downplayed the witness testimony of villagers near the crash site, which suggested foul play. And there were many witnesses who were willing to formally testify that what they saw was looked to be as though another plane shooting another plane down. The residents of the western outskirts of Mandola described a Hammarskjöld's DC-6 as being shot down by a second smaller aircraft.
You're listening to USUN Report, and we're talking about Dag Hammarskjöld today, his life and death. Stay with us. You're listening to USUN Report, and we're talking about Dag Hammarskjöld today, his life and death.
They say the crash was sealed off by Northern Rhodesian security forces, as David said, the next morning, and hours before the wreckage was officially declared found. And the witnesses and the people surrounding the area were told to leave. The key witnesses were located and interviewed over the past 3 years. One, Göran Borkdahl, a Swedish aid worker who was based in Africa, who made the investigation of the Hammarskjöld mystery a personal quest since discovering his father had a fragment of the crash DC-6. He went around asking local people what happened, and they gave him a piece of the plane. And so then he continued his quest and began to question systematically on what they had seen. And clearly from the days leading up to Hammarskjöld's death on the 17th of September, illustrates clear U.S. and British anger at an abortive U.N. military operation that the Secretary General ordered on behalf of the Congolese government. This was against a rebellion backed by Western mining companies, and so there were dollars involved here. Hammarskjöld was flying to Ndola for peace talks with Katanga leadership that the British helped arrange. And as we know, the fiercely independent Swedish diplomat had by then enraged almost all the major powers of the Security Council with his support for decolonization. And today, of course, the United Nations is one of the great champions of that. So this becomes very complex, but to basically summarize the findings, Borkdahl concludes that Hammarskjöld's plane was almost certainly shot down by an unidentified second plane, that the actions of the British and Northern Rhodesian officials at the scene delayed the search for the missing plane, and the wreckage was found and sealed off by Northern Rhodesian troops and police long before its discovery was officially announced. The one survivor of the crash could have been saved. He was one of the Secretary General's security people, but was allowed to die in a poorly equipped hospital. Some believe that this was allowed to happen because he would serve as a witness, which might incriminate the U.S. and Britain. Many details to follow, but these are the stark facts that the latest investigations have turned up. Ken?
Dr. Canerva, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, what I find interesting about this is that 2 weeks ago we talked about Vladimir Putin and some of his scurrilous activity, such as trying to assassinate former Russian spies in Britain. And now we find back in 1961 that maybe the hands of the British and possibly the Americans weren't so clean either. Yeah.
Ken, if I could just interject here, you know, this reminds me of the tragedy that we had in Srebrenica, where the West was being accused of of allowing the massacre, or I should say, the war crimes to take place there, because this would be a new community of Islam in the Western world. So the West has not always had clean hands in these situations. Ken?
Well, now in my research for this particular show, I stumbled on a book titled Vagmarken, which means markings in Swedish, published in 1963. It's the only book by the former UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld. And this journal was discovered after his death. He referred to this piece of work as concerning my negotiations with myself and with God. It's almost like he had a premonition of what was to come. The book was translated into English in 1964 and received rave reviews in the New York Times. Tom, in our last 30 seconds, would you care to comment about the book?
I certainly would. Markings was one of my favorite books. It was a gift from a very dear friend who loved poetry and prose. And it was a brilliant book, not quite poetry, but more prose. Highly recommended. It's called Markings, Dag Hammarskjöld. USUN Report, I'm Tom Osborne with Dr. David Canerbo and Ken McCaleb. Ken?
Thanks, Tom. Here's an audio clip from the author of a book titled The Incubus of Intervention by Paul Polgrain.
This book, Incubus of Intervention, you're talking about 25 years of interviews. Now, you mentioned Dag Hammarskjöld, his assassination.
Yes. Last year, in the United Nations had another investigation. They finally decided it should be called assassination. It wasn't a plane crash. But what happened in 61 was Hammarskjöld was basically flying in to a Ndola, which was quite a few thousand feet up in the Congo-Rhodesia area, and he was coming in just after midnight, and the plane crashed. And people are wondering, oh, well, you know, what went wrong? But Bishop Tutu from South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 1998 was just concluding his investigations for that commission when an envelope turned up with 10 letters and stuck down the bottom, and they were dealing with the death of Hammarskjöld, and they were an intelligence group in South Africa was named, and it seems to have been very close with the CIA, if not the CIA.
These are turbulent times. This is the 60s, Tom Osborne. Why was everybody so gung-ho about assassinating at that time?
Well, of course, it was the height of the Cold War, and people were lining up on either side, not necessarily because they cared or believed what that particular side said, but they were doing it for protection at home and abroad. It was interesting that there was no announcement, for example, for people to come forward with information following the crash, and the federal government didn't want people to talk about it. There were some who witnessed the crash, and they were taken away and imprisoned. Ken?
Well, you know, as I mentioned in our last segment, I would read from his book, Markings, and here's a thought. When you've reached the point where you no longer expect a response, you will at last be able to give in such a way that the other is able to receive and be grateful. When love is matured and through a dissolution of the self into light, become a radiance, then shall the lover be liberated from dependence upon the beloved, and the beloved can also be made perfect by being liberated from the lover. This doesn't sound like a politician. This sounds more like a poet, Tom.
Well, it sounds like somebody who's really concerned with humanity, doesn't it? It sounds like somebody who could take over an organization like the United Nations, which has impossible ideals. And that's the kind of man he was. Reading that book really was very inspiring for me. I read it when I was in college. And he made politics into a peace tool. He was very good at using politics. He knew what he was doing, and he knew where he was going, and he cared sincerely about that. Ken?
Here's another one. You wake from dreams of doom, and for a moment you know, beyond all the noise and gestures, the only real thing, love's calm, unwavering flame in the half-light of an early dawn. Dr. Canervo, that was a very optimistic outlook from a time that was filled with turbulence.
Yes, certainly it was. And I think to a certain extent he was trying to maybe separate the problems and the troubles of the day from a more idealized view of life and the fact that we tend to be perhaps too overburdened in life with the daily worries and concerns about politics and war and those sorts of things. And instead we need to put our faith other places. Ken?
Here's some more. To have humility is to experience reality, not in relation to ourselves, but in its sacred independence. It is to see, judge, and act from the point of rest in ourselves. Then how much disappears and all that remains falls into place. And in the point of rest at the center of our being, we encounter a world where all things are at rest in the same way. Then a tree becomes a mystery, a cloud a revelation, each man a cosmos, of whose riches we can only catch glimpses. The life of simplicity is simple, but it opens us to a book in which we never get beyond the first syllable. These are incredible thoughts. They're almost transcendent, wouldn't you say, Tom?
Well, actually, that's the very word I was hoping I could get in edgewise, was transcendence. He gave us a tremendous, wonderful feeling of transcendence, even from the most unsolvable problems and the worst tragedies of the world. He tried to find a way of transcending that. And that made him an absolute perfect man for being the Secretary General of the United Nations. Ken?
When I read, forgiveness breaks the chain of causality because he who forgives you out of love takes upon himself the consequences of what you've done. Forgiveness, therefore, always entails a sacrifice. Now, he was addressing many of the World War II players. And at a time, like we were discussing earlier, when China and Russia were barely members of the United Nations, I mean, Russia certainly was, but China hadn't quite made the step yet. And you think that he was handing out a carrot or reaching out to countries that didn't belong at that point?
Well, I'd like to pick up on that. I think if you look at the time of that period, people were so exhausted by war. I mean, we'd had World War II and then the Korean War. And finally, there was a breathing room for just for a few moments. And that's when these people came into our lives. And they took over positions which never existed before. And they did things that never happened before. So that's what made them very unusual. Ken?
Well, his life and his death and his words and his actions have done more to shape public expectations of the office of the Secretary General and, indeed, of the organization, the United Nations, than those of any other man or woman in its history. His wisdom and his modesty, his unimpeachable integrity, and single-minded devotion to duty have set a standard for all servants of the international community. Has he set the bar rather high for anybody else who might come in the future? David?
I certainly think he has. He really is very much a role model for what diplomacy should be. The fact that he was controversial because he offended all sides shows his fairness and equanimity. He offended communists, but he offended the democratic countries as well, because he wanted what was right and what was fair, in many cases for the smaller, newly independent nations of the world. He wanted nations to be independent, self-governing, and he fought for that. One of the things I found interesting about his service as Secretary General was that he was very much a hands-on player. He didn't send delegates from him various places all the time. He did occasionally, but he traveled and put a lot of miles on his plane himself because he wanted to be there doing the actual negotiating and settling disputes between and among different countries. So I think that's a very high bar, not only because of that activity, but because of his outlook on life and his outlook on the world, that there's so much more we can do if we have peace. Ken?
Within a month or so after his death, a number of cities, including West Berlin, decided to change the names of streets and squares and call them Dag Hammarskjöld. I know we have one right in Manhattan on 47th Street. I started my first television job in Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza. Later on, in 61, there was a library at the UN named after him. And shortly after Dag Hammarskjöld's death, the United Nations Correspondents Association, which is UNCA, and Tom, you were president of UNCA, they set up a Dag Hammarskjöld Memorial Scholarship Fund in his honor. Were you aware of that, Tom?
Yes, I am. It's a very, very important part of what United Nations Correspondents Association does every year. It brings a foreign or someone from overseas to the United Nations and helps them in their reportage as they get the experience of what it's like to be there. Ken?
That's right. And since the establishment of this fund, many journalists from Africa, Asia, Latin America were all brought to New York to see what it's like to be a reporter with the United Nations. You're listening to USUN Report with Tom Osborne, Dr. David Canervo, and Ken McCaleb. And we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to USUN Report. This is our wrap-up or summarized segment of our show. Dr. David Canerva, you've studied Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld rather extensively. Are we missing any clues as to his impact on the world in both life and death?
Well, I don't think so. It seems to me that he certainly had an enormous impact, both in Sweden specifically, but then worldwide as well, as Secretary General of the UN. We haven't talked really much about his work in Sweden, but he was very much involved in the economic system there. He was very much involved in the Swedish economy. He coined the term planned economy, and along with his brother was instrumental in drafting legislation which created the so-called welfare system in Sweden that most of us are now familiar with. So he had a major impact in that country, and then you move on to the United Nations and his vast travels trying to put fires out around the world and bring peace to the world after all the years of war during World War II in Korea. Ken?
Well, we mentioned him earlier in the show, but here's what former Secretary General Kofi Annan had to say about him during one of his reflections. He was this is his framework for a lecture that Kofi did as he toured. He would say things like this. Hammarskjöld expressed the conviction that the United Nations must be a dynamic instrument for change in the world rather than a form of static conference machinery. Have we turned into a static conference machinery, Tom?
Yes. I think we have. And the United Nations knows that, and the world knows that. It's as though we've reached our limits in terms of how close we can come to peace. And there is this huge barrier between us right now. We've come as far as we can. That's the feeling I have about it, Ken.
Dr. Canervo, John Bolton, who has just been named to President Trump's cabinet, he felt that the top 11 floors of the UN could be chopped off and nobody would notice. Was that a fair assessment?
I suspect not. I think that we have a tremendous amount of work to do in the world to try to make it more habitable for a lot of people in less developed countries. We have an infinite number of fires to put out to try to bring peace to the world, lasting peace, which will allow us to develop more close relationships. And so it seems to me that that takes people to do that, and to cut off all the bureaucracy of the United Nations, I think certainly would be a mistake, because while they are nameless, faceless bureaucrats in many ways, nevertheless, they are people who do important work in a lot of different areas around the world. Ken?
Kofi also went on to say these principles were important in the context of the Cold War and are every bit as relevant today, yet industrialized countries remain reluctant to see the United Nations act on Hammarskjöld's second principle, and some governments are equally loath to see it actively promote respect for and observance of human rights and fundamental freedoms for all. Tom Osborne, we have just about a minute left. Would you like to conclude our show?
Certainly, Ken. I would just add that Dag Hammarskjöld was one of the few people in leadership in our government and in the world, really, that has left such a lasting mark, not only in the United States, but also internationally. And I'm sure many young people in school haven't studied him yet, because he is not that well known to people outside the United Nations circles. But he was a wonderful leader at a great time, and when we were desperate, unfortunately it ended in tragedy. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have today. I hope you'll join us next week when we bring breaking news of the week on USUN Report. I'm Tom Osborne for Ken McCaleb, our moderator, and David Canervo, our resident historian and political scientist. Thank you for joining us.